All righty. Somebody needs to pass out the church planting handout. And this is one of the few places where I really see that the order of these talks, this is good and right for this to be the last, because what I'll say here pretty draws very much on almost everything else we've said today and in the other talks this year. I certainly want to get to the practicals, but let's talk about, this is about church planting, and in the very beginning I point out the fact that church planting is absolutely natural. That may sound an odd thing to say, but if you go to the book of Acts and you read about the early church mission, you see basically three things that Paul always does, three things that happen in whenever Christian mission happens in a city. The first part, this is on page one, but you know, don't have to look, you know, this is on page one here. The first person is there's evangelism. Paul does what he needs to do in order to connect the gospel to people's hearts, and he sees conversions. The second thing he does is he builds them up. Sometimes he wins them, and then he travels around. He comes back to encourage them. There's lots of interesting places where he comes back to edify and build up the converts. So there's evangelism. There's what we call follow-up discipleship, sanctification, teaching. But then the third thing always is that he finds leaders, and he puts leaders over the church. And when he does that, instead of keeping them under him directly, when he does that and he puts in elders and he puts in people to shepherd, what he's actually doing is he's planting a church. Instead of they're not just part of his ministry now. He's raising up people and he's putting them over the converts, and that's a church. And so what you actually have on every page in Acts is church planting. Now, you know, we talk an awful lot about secessionism. Are you a secessionist? Or do you believe? I'm sorry, you know, with our accents, who knows what that word means, right? There's people who say, the gifts of the Spirit, tongues and prophecy have ceased. That makes you a cessationist. Secessionist? No, secessionist is what we did in the Civil War. We seceded. Seceding and cessating, anyway. So if you believe that the gifts have ceased, you're not a Pentecostal. And if you believe the gifts have ceased, you are a Pentecostal. But I think when you read the book of Acts and whenever you talk about cessationism, it means, do you believe the gifts have stopped or do you believe they're for today? There's a very weird kind of cessationism that's going on. When you look at the book of Acts, you see church planting happening all the time. Everybody did it. Every church planted churches. Because, of course, when you grew your house church to the place where you got too many people, you had to start another house church. And therefore, church planting was the natural part of all ministry. And you know what? We don't see it that way anymore. There's a different kind of cessationism going on. See? There's a tendency for us now to think that a church has its ministry, and it does music, and it does worship, and it does education, and it does preaching, and it does teaching, and it does all these things. And church planting, isn't that an interesting idea? Who's going to do that? That's very rare. That's odd. That's weird. No. Actually, I actually would say that every church should preach the word, should educate its people, should worship, should do all these things, and it should be planting churches. Church planting, according to the Bible, is as natural to what the church does as all those other things. And we don't see it that way. When you plant a church that has church planting in its DNA, it automatically says we're doing these things. We're worshiping, we're preaching, we're educating, and we're planting a church. It's something that we're always in the process of doing. We're looking to plant a church. By the way, when you have a set of churches, all of which think of church planting as natural and as intrinsic to ministry as all the other things I just mentioned, you've got a movement going. And that's what we don't have. And actually, Richard, are you still here? Richard had a lead, right? Richard Coffey, yeah. Well, Richard had you know what I realized he was getting at the very end of what I said? He's talking about generals and lieutenants, actually, and field marshals. I wasn't quite sure what that meant. I thought it was some new British vocabulary. What he meant was, he was looking at me as a general, meaning I'm a pastor of one of the largest churches. And because I'm a pastor of one of the largest churches, I believe that church planting is absolutely natural. That you can't, unless you're planting churches, you're really not doing all the things that the book of Acts says a church should be doing. And what he was saying is that we have some lieutenants that think that way, but we have almost none of the generals. Meaning, I guess I won't name names, but I guess he means pastors of the biggest, most prominent churches don't say to their church things like that. And if that's the case, yeah, he's right that you're not going to be a dynamic. You're not going to have movement dynamics in London unless your generals are saying this, as well as your lieutenants. Okay, so round up your generals, get them into a corner, and force feed them this paper. Anyway, okay, that's the first page. So it's absolutely crucial to understanding church planting is as natural to what every church should do as all the other ministries. And if you get that into people's DNA, then you're going to find you've got a movement going. One of the greatest things I know anybody's told me about Redeemer's ministry, though I hope the statistics are still valid, but at least a couple years ago we did a study of all the churches that we've helped plant in various ways, either planted directly as daughter churches or partner churches, and something like 70% of them plant another church within 5 years. Do you remember that, Mark? Yeah. At one point we did an analysis of about 100 to 120 churches that we helped plant, and we discovered that 70% of them planted a daughter church within 5 years of being planted. Now, when that happens, you're on your way. You really are, because when that begins to happen, then off we go. Okay. Second page. I don't know that this is all that crucial. Perhaps I should show you on the second page that biblically, from what I can tell from the book of Acts, there's two basic ways of planting a church. I call it pioneer church planting and church planting. One of the problems with doing spell check on this is every place I talked about church planting, when I did my spell check, I kept trying to delete one of the churches. I said, delete church? No. Delete church? And there's pioneer church planting and church planting. Pioneer church planting is when a missionary or a pastor or a team just simply goes out to start a church from scratch. Look at the over here. The minister and the leaders are often self-initiators. A church could call and send a pioneer, but by and large, the pioneer is working from scratch, going into an area, gathering people. In church planting, church leaders are selected by a church body, and members tend to come from the mother church, and they could come from the mother church because, you know, here's a mother church, and we see we've got some people commuting in from this far suburb, so we start a church there. But it's also possible for the mother church to actually pick up five or six families and have them all move to another place and start the church. That's still church planting. So if you're going back and forth and looking at these columns, pioneer church planting is the minister and leader are self-initiators, where in the other situations, the church leaders are selected by the church body. There's usually no core members in pioneer church planting. The pioneer gets all the core through networking and evangelism. Whereas in church planting, members come from pooling cell groups or hiving off distant families. Now, by the way, one of the ways that works is you can either say, here's seven families and they all come from this area, so we're going to get together with them and start a church. But there's other ways of doing it. One of them is through small groups. And what you can do is if you have three small groups or two small groups in a region that's far from your church, you can say to them, or one small group, you know, one Bible study of six or seven people, you could say, over the next 18 months, let's really, really reach out, begin to do evangelism through our groups, and let's try to grow this into three small groups. Let's just pray and seek to, instead of being one small group of eight people, that we'll be three small groups of 24, 25 people in a year. And let's do this through evangelism, through outreach. And if you find yourself getting three and four and five small groups, that's God's way of saying, you know, the fields are white under harvest, let's go. I'll give you another way, by the way. I know a church that does church planting, not through small groups, but through mid-sized groups. And there's a church doing this in New York, doing it very well, and here's how it works. They start with what they call a missional community of about 18 to 20 people. So if you have 18 to 20 people from your church, and your church is in Manhattan, and there's 18 to 20 people in Park Slope, Brooklyn, you say, we want you to start meeting every week as a missional community. Now, the missional community meets as it's not a small group, but it's not a worship service. It's a mid-sized group in which people get together to eat and to think about how to reach out to their neighborhood and to talk about what it would be like to be a congregation out here. And a missional community especially works for about six, the way they start a church is for about 6 months, the missional community meets as a group of about 15 to 20 people every week. And they work on service projects in the neighborhood. They work on finding out if there's a nursing home, and they find out there's a... And they look around for ways to serve in the community and really get to know the people of their neighborhood. They also do a lot of personal evangelism, and they get back together and they tell stories. And in many cases, they bring their non-Christian friends to the missional community. And so they're operating not as a small group or as a worship service, a big group. They're operating as a missional community. After about 5 or 6 months, they go into small groups. They divide themselves into about 4 small groups of 4 or 5 each. And then they begin to meet on alternate weeks as a small group and on alternate weeks as a missional community. Understand? So they meet as a large group this Wednesday night, and then the next Wednesday night they meet in their small groups. And then they meet in the missional community, they meet in the small groups. And what they have found that small groups tend to be inward-focused unless they're part of a mid-sized group that's putting a lot of emphasis on reaching out to their neighborhood. So for 3 to 6 months, they meet as a missional community every week. Then for 3 to 6 months, they meet alternating as a missional community and then as small groups. The small groups almost immediately begin to grow because they have got this outward orientation. And so after about 3 or 4 months, they find that their missional community has grown from about 15 to 50 people. I mean, after two stages, 3 to 4 months as a missional community, 3 to 4 months as missional and small groups. So anywhere from 6 to 8 months, they move usually from 15 people to about 50 ordinarily. And when they get to 50 people, they consider that the limit to how big they can be meeting in a missional community, and they divide into 2 missional communities. And then they go with that until both missional communities are full. And when they get to 2 missional communities, with anywhere from 5 to 15 small groups and about 100 people coming, then they begin a Sunday morning worship service. And usually when they start the Sunday morning worship service, 150 to 180 people show up. And they got a church. And on they go. And that church usually then has 3 or 4 missional communities. And then what they do is, if you want to start a church in another neighborhood, you find a missional community, you say, we have a vision that you're going to become a congregation. And on they go. So that's church planting. That's church planting. Whereas pioneer church planting is a pioneer goes off and works because there's not a lot of core people there. It's a neighborhood that's not being reached. You don't have any good churches around. Or it's a people group that's not being reached very well. And it just has to be done by the pioneer. The other things I'll show you here is, in pioneer church planting, where's the money come from? It comes from a combination of these possibilities. A mission agency gives you the money, and or you raise the money from personal friends and churches that you know for your support, if you're the missionary, and or you do some self-employment. You know, you might be a tent maker, you might have a half-time job or a full-time job, and or all three. In other words, you could do 2 of the 3 or all 3 or just 1 of the 3, and that's how you get your money. Whereas if you look at money on the other side of church planting, here's what usually happens there. You get your core group of people, that first group of people that said we're going to start a church. You get a pledge from them. I always used to be grumpy. In other words, if we had 20 people and we said we want to start a church with you, could you pledge and tell us how much money you will give to the church plant over the next 12 months? Whenever the pledges would come in, it was always way more than I knew they were probably giving the mother church. And I used to say, you weren't giving Redeemer that kind of money. I know it. But anyway, sorry, I'm not supposed to think those thoughts. But I'm just trying to be real candid with you. Being American, you know, we watch Oprah, so, you know, we just have no scruples. But honestly, what happens is if you take 20 people and you say, will you give money to this new church plant? They always give more money than they were giving to the mother church. That's actually part of the way in which church planting brings more resources into the kingdom. So you get a core group pledge from your core group. Then secondly, you get a gift subsidy from the mother church. And then thirdly, the church planter very often can get some supplementary grants from distant churches or friends, and off you go. So you get a core group pledge. You get usually a decreasing grant from the mother church. We'll give you this much this year, a little less than this year, a little less this year, and then you're off. And you get money from distant places, and that's how you do church planting. Usually in pioneer church planting, the mentoring and the supervision very often can be kind of distant and hard and remote and thin, whereas in church planting, the mentor is nearby. Very often the mentor is the pastor of the church that's planting you, and it's very, very thick, and it's better. And lastly, pioneer church planting, however, tends to be more innovative. It usually forges new models or imitates maybe distant ones, whereas church planting tends to replicate the mother. So church planting, as great as it is, tends to create churches that are pretty much they're relatively similar. So when you've got dynamic, fast church planting, this church is planting a church, and then those churches plant churches, and it's exciting, but they tend to be less innovative. They tend to be more replication of the mama church. Whereas pioneer church planting, where you don't have a core group, and you go off and you start with kind of with evangelism, and you're really reaching the community, tends to be an R&D department in the city. That is usually research and development. And usually those kinds of churches produce the new innovative ideas that everybody in about 10 years wants to do as well. But they were invented in those kinds of churches. Then, I think, on the next page, just what I'm basically trying to say on the pages that have to do with natural church planting, pages 3 and 4, is church planting takes a mindset of kingdom-mindedness. Church planting requires that the gospel has really affected your heart. Because one of the reasons why people don't want to do church planting, it means you lose control. I gave an example in there of a church I know in Darien, Connecticut, that for many years had a little church building. They filled it up. They only seated 100 people. And whenever anybody said, you need to plant a church, you need to send people out to plant a church, they wouldn't do it. And they did it. It was very successful. They're kicking themselves now why they didn't do it before. And they look back and they realize it really was the ministers didn't want to lose control. And you do lose control to some degree. Or the ministers didn't want to lose money. They were afraid that if we sent out, good giving families, we'll never make that up. If we lose that family, they give well, we're never going to make that up in new funds. And it's a need for control, and it's a fear of failure, and it's a deep insecurity, and it's a lack of faith, and it's also a lack of grace. The gospel makes you not need to control everything. The gospel makes it not necessary for your tribe to be bigger. You don't mind losing people. You don't mind having people go out. I mentioned some of those things in there. So many of the attitudes that keep us from planting churches are gospel issues. The reason we don't plant churches is not just hidebound traditionalism. It's not just an inability to think outside the box. It's not just a lack of creativity. It's not just a lack of entrepreneurship. It's fear. It's insecurity. It's the need for control. It's a lot of things that are sin. So, by the way, there's sinful reasons to want to plant churches too. Empire building, and so on. So I don't want you to think that if you want to plant churches, your heart must be pure. And if you don't want to plant churches, your heart must be sinful. I'm just wanting you to know that an awful lot of the reasons why we don't plant are sinful. Okay, page 5. Do you know how to do a quick apologia? Do you know how to win people over to church planting. What I have on page 5, and this is all over the internet, so if you have never seen this, it's because you maybe, well, maybe you haven't. Page 5, 6, 7, and 8 are my little apologia for why we need to plant churches. It's just it's a bang, bang, bang set of bullet points when you're trying to make the case to your people, to your supervisor, to, you know, maybe as Richard is right, you lieutenants need to start to get the generals in the corner and start to, you know, bark these things at them. I don't know. But here's what they are. Here are some reasons for planting churches. A, the best way to evangelize is not through evangelistic programs, but through churches. Having said what I said before about the need for these specialist parachurch ministries, I'm all for that. Nevertheless, there's no better way to evangelize somebody than to bring them into a church. You know why? Because when people make a decision, that usually does not mean, say, I want to be a Christian. That does not usually mean that they've become a Christian when they make their decision. It usually means they're on their way in a process. And the best way for a person who's on their way to incubate, to hear the gospel constantly, to really be brought into full faith is in a full church. And not just simply in a Bible study, not just simply in a parachurch ministry. Well, that's number one. B, the main way to increase the number of Christians in a city is not mainly through church renewal, but through church planting. This might not be, okay, this is going to sound real American, okay? This is not, look here. I know this isn't the way, I love being here. I feel I'm relatively bicultural. I understand the difference between the way Americans think and British people think. I respect and I've learned a tremendous amount from British Christianity. My wife always says, whenever I say, do you mind me going to London again, honey? And she says, no, it's part of our repaying our debt to British Christianity, to which we owe everything practically. Okay, having said that, I know I'm going to sound real American, but just look. New churches are more open to new people. Doesn't that make sense? Old churches, you have to have been in the church for 10 or 20 years before you're even allowed to be a leader. New churches are open to new people. They're open to new ideas. And this is the reason why old churches, no matter how evangelistic they are, only probably add 10 at the most, 20% at the most of their new members are new converts. If you find a church in which 20% of the people that joined the church last year were new converts, that church is doing pretty well. But brand new congregations, often in America, we've done a lot of studies of this because Americans like studies, and we found that anywhere from a third to a half of the people who join brand new churches are people who were not going to any church before. So new churches, for the first 15 years of their lives, bring in a third to a half or even more of their new members are unchurched people. Whereas older churches, almost always, the vast majority of the people that come into an old church are people coming from other old churches. They've come because they've moved. They've come because, you know, they've moved or become, they like your program better. Therefore, new churches bring in non-Christians at 6 to 8 times a higher rate than old churches do. What this means is simple. If you got 100 churches in town, and all of them are 15 years old or older, the number of Christians in that town is shrinking. Because even though there's always some churches that are doing better than other churches, the churches that are growing are almost always in that town growing at the expense of the other churches. So what you've actually got is just a recirculation of the saints. And there's always more churches in decline than there are churches growing. And overall, the number of Christians in that city is diminishing. So if you have 100 churches and none of them are new, the number of Christians in town is shrinking. If you have 100 churches in town and 1% is new, you have one new church in town, believe it or not, that one or two new churches will be probably winning enough new people to Christ that it'll probably be keeping the number of Christians in town about the same. Our studies have shown that if a denomination is planting 1% of its... If a denomination of 1,000 churches is planting 10 new churches a year, it keeps the membership numbers the same. If there's If that denomination is planting no churches, the numbers are diminishing. If it's planting 1% of new churches, the numbers stay the same. On the other hand, if in a town of 100, 5 to 10 churches are always 15 years old or younger, then the number of Christians in that town are growing. So the key is to always have at least 5 to 10% of your churches that are in your town be new. Now you might say, but that, I know that sounds like, where's the Bible? Well, I've just told you, the Bible says church planting is just absolutely natural. It happens all the time. 5% is way too small. I mean, if you're really going to go by what the Bible says about church planting, what I'm suggesting is that at least 5 to 10% of all the churches in London will have been planted in the last 15 years. You don't say, where is that in the Bible? Well, that's way below the biblical standard. Don't get on me for that. I'm just telling you statistically what happens. Unless you're planting churches at that rate, the number of Christians in a city is shrinking. But if you're planting churches at that rate, at 5, 10, 15%, then the number of Christians in the city are growing, and then you're moving toward a tipping point. Here's a couple others on page 6. At the bottom of page 6, when somebody says to you, well, why would you plant new churches when there's all these other churches that need to be renewed, right? How could you plant new churches when there's all these churches out there that aren't even full? They're dying. It'd be better to renew those older churches than it is to plant new churches. And I'm telling you that the best way to renew the existing churches of a city is by planting new ones. It is not either or. There is absolutely no doubt. Just to give you a quick example of this is when I started a church in Manhattan 20 years ago, the big steeple churches were all pretty liberal. Even the ones that consider themselves evangelical were very liberal, pretty much. And along comes Redeemer, and we grew fast and saw a lot of people become Christians. And I know this for a fact because I knew people on the search committee. Over the next, after Redeemer had been up and running for 5 years, a number of the big steeple churches were looking for new ministers. And there was somebody on every search committee that started to say, we need to go out and get an expository preacher. And they said, what? And they said, yeah, I would never have thought that expository preaching would win people to Christ in Manhattan. But there's this church Redeemer. It's got 1,000 people after 5 years. And all they do, when you go into the services, and the guy actually expounds the Bible. Let's try that. Now, you might say that's a pretty pragmatic argument. Yeah, but I'm just giving you the example. I know that 3 or 4 of the big steeple churches got more evangelical ministers in the next 5 or 6 years because of us. There is just no doubt about it. But that's not all. What I put down here is top of page 7. I just have to summarize this. New churches bring new ideas into the city that the older churches then pick up and use because they didn't have the guts to do it themselves. But when the new churches do them and succeed with them, then the old churches say, oh, we got to try that. New churches in some cases can actually renew the mother church. Very often, and I've seen this a number of times, the daughter church thrives so much that a lot of the vitality and the ideas from the daughter church washes back up into the mother church. And also, what happens at Redeemer, by the way, is Redeemer very often wins people to Christ who then don't stay at Redeemer. They go back to churches that are more like, how do I say it? If you're upper crust, you become a Christian at Redeemer, which is kind of middle class professional. The person might find their way back to an upper crust kind of church as a new believer, because that's where their family is, that's where their networks are, and we know that we're kind of an evangelistic feeder to a lot of other churches in the city. And so in all these ways, to say, you don't need to start new churches because we need to renew the existing churches, well, you always say the best way to renew the existing churches is to start new churches. And I think the rest of this is, well, here's two more. The bottom of page 7, another important reason to plant churches is the way to reach the sheer diversity of the city is through new churches. We all know that new immigrants are best reached by a church that is in their language. That younger generations are best reached by a church that is at least to some degree adapted to their generational speak. There's a danger. We've talked about this under contextualization. There's always a danger of over-contextualizing to a new group of people so that the church becomes too homogeneous, it becomes too narrow, it becomes too focused on one group of people. But I'm afraid so many times people have said to me, I'm down on contextualization because I don't want to adapt to young people because then you just become a glorified youth group. And besides that, they need to grow up. Well, you know what you're really saying is, I've contextualized to my generation. They don't like to say that. When you say, I don't want to contextualize that generation, I want to just preach the gospel. Well, what it means is you got to be contextualized to some generation. Well, we've been through that. We've talked about that earlier. However, having said that there's dangers with that, generally speaking, the way to reach new groups of people, new generations, and new residents to a city is through new congregations. They're almost always more likely to find their way into those congregations. And then, last of all, page 8, the last reason you need to plant churches, new churches are the only ministries that become self-supporting and expand the base of resources for all other ministries in the city. If you start a ministry, an evangelistic ministry to Muslims, and you have 3 workers, you want to go to 4 workers, 5 workers, where are you going to get the money for that? You know, you have to go to churches to get the money, or individuals in churches to get the money. When you start a church, eventually it takes an outlay of money, but then after a while, the church begins to become a funder itself. And so, to be ridiculous, I just remember Terry Geiger, my boss, old boss, and now who works for me, actually, at the Church Planting Center. Terry will always, I forget what the numbers are, he'll add up how much money he raised to start Redeemer, and then he'll add up how much money Redeemer put into ministry in the first 10 years of its existence. And the amount of ministry that Redeemer put into ministry is like this. The amount of ministry it took us to start was this. Now, admittedly, Redeemer got big fast, and it doesn't always work that way, so it's kind of a little bit of an unfair example. But it's true. When you start churches, they are the one kind of ministry that then becomes a resource for all the other ministries of the city. So as important as it is to start parachurch ministries, you better start churches, because if you start churches, that's a tide that lifts all the boats. Now, lastly, but very most importantly, how do you start a church? And how in the world could you possibly, when I just said there's pioneer church planting, there's church planting, those are two radically different ways of going about things. Is there anything you can say that I think would be true across the board for church planting that everybody ought to do, no matter what other method you're doing? And I would say, on page 9, I'm just going to give you my last ideas on this, methodology. On page 9, these are general things that aren't just for church planting. They're just for urban ministry. Requirements for church effectiveness in general, if you want my summary, you have to know the gospel and communicate the gospel, not a click toward law or a click toward license. You got to hit it just right. Moralism is truth without grace, which isn't really truth. Relativism is grace without truth, which isn't really grace. To the degree a ministry fails to do justice to both, it loses life-changing power. Both the holiness and the love of God must have equal emphasis. So if you're too much to legalism, too much to license, and not hitting it just right, you're not changing people's lives. If you hit the gospel right, you have life-changing power. The second basic requirement for church effectiveness in general is contextualization. You have to know the culture and adapt it, not a click, little, too little, or too much. If you over-adapt to a culture, it means you've accepted the culture's idols. If you under-adapt to a culture, it means you've accepted your own culture's idols. You know, the way, we've talked about this. To the degree a ministry is over or under-adapted to the culture, it loses culture-transforming power. So if you are contextualized just right, which nobody is, by the way, and if you're preaching the gospel just perfectly, which nobody does, by the way, you have life-changing power, and you see growth. You see people's lives changed. Another way to put it would be, if you think of the gospel as here's law, here's license, and the gospel is hitting it perfectly between legalism and antinomianism, and then you have another axis like this, and over here is over-adapting to the culture and giving people what they want to hear over here is under adapting to the culture, being culturally rigid and just doing things your own way. And in the middle is this perfect, you know, cultural adaptation without compromising the gospel. The closer you can get to the very center, the more of a revival you're going to have, the more dynamic you're going to have, the more life-changing power you're going to have. And nobody gets right there. But you're trying, you're pushing toward that center. You're pushing toward the center. And that's the requirements for any kind of church effectiveness. Okay, then down at the bottom of page 9, requirements for urban church effectiveness, not church planting, but just urban church effectiveness. You need to have a vision for your neighborhood and your city, not just for your church. You should have a concrete vision of what your city and what your neighborhood could look like if the people were changed by the gospel. And you should be so committed to living in the neighborhood you're reaching and identifying with the people that you're there long term. And if you're not there, see, if you don't have this vision for the neighborhood and if you don't identify with the people, if you just look at them as these awful people we're trying to reach, and you don't identify as one of them, then as I put down here, you will, when you preach and communicate, you'll talk past the issues, or their issues, or you'll talk to issues that people don't have. You'll miss the issues they do have. You won't really know them. Your preaching, your communication won't really hit home. So you have to have a vision for your neighborhood, and you have to identify with it. Secondly, you have to have a conviction that you and the gospel are needed. That is, you have to believe that you've got something to contribute to make this city what God wants it to be. But on the other hand, you've got to believe that you need the city to help you find God in the gospel. There's a balance here. It is so critical. On the one hand, you've got to feel like the city needs me, and the gospel that God has shown me is the truth. Now, most evangelicals don't have a problem with that one. But the other side is, it's not just the city needs you, but you need the city. There are aspects of the gospel's power that you will never see if you don't live in a city. There's the people of the city are going to press you to find things in God that you wouldn't have found otherwise. At some point, you will wake up and say, if I hadn't come to the city and to minister, I would never have really come to understand how big God is, how gracious He is, how great He is. So there has to be a kind of a balance between a conviction that you and the gospel are needed by the city, and also a conviction that you need the city and its people to teach you about the gospel. Now, having said that, here's my four stages of church planting. I'm calling them learning, loving, linking, and launching. And you say, oh, you've got a little Welsh blood in you somewhere. No, I don't think so. But I realize that Welsh Presbyterians used to preach like this. I had a professor preaching at Gordon Conwell years ago named Gwyn Walters. He was Welsh, and all of his sermons started with the same, all of his points always start with the same letter. I never figured this out until later on. They said, oh, he's Welsh. Did I just offend somebody's racial identity? Forgive me. I liked it, so I wasn't knocking it. Learning means, and this is where you tend not to do this, most of us are part of a group of people that feels like, oh, we've got such a vision for our kind of Christianity, that you go into a neighborhood and your job is just to propagate your version of Christianity. No, your first job is to do research to get to know the people and the culture as well as you know the gospel, which, by the way, isn't as hard as it sounds, because the gospel is infinitely deep and people are not. An interior life profile. What are their greatest hopes? What are their greatest aspirations and pleasures? What are their greatest fears and problems? What are their greatest strengths? What are their greatest weaknesses? Do you know that? Can you write a whole little book on that? You do this through personal interviews, through periodicals and sociological research, through reading literature, to watching movies, to reading novels. You need to know what are their big hopes, what are their aspirations, their pleasures. And secondly, contextual life means who's actually there? What are the demographics? What are discern material economic groupings, social structures, power relations between groupings, who's on top, who's in the middle, who's on the bottom, what groups are there. Thirdly, a worldview profile. You've got to know what aspects of biblical truth does their worldview basically accept through common grace. We talked about this last time, too. And what aspects did they deny or miss? What symbols and myths function deeply in the worldview? And where are there problems in their worldview? Where are there tensions and pressure points? We talked about this in the past. What is the people's story? Who do they see themselves to be? Where they're from, where they're going? And then what's the apologetics raw material? What are the defeater beliefs that in that culture make Christianity implausible? Okay. What are the A doctrines, which are biblical beliefs that are similar to what they already accept as true, and the B doctrines, biblical beliefs that they find offensive? And there's two ways to learn these things: informal, living here and spending time there; formal, which is studying statistics, so on. So that's learning. Then loving, which basically is the spirituality and disciplines of life while you're carrying out the strategy. You've got to go into the greatest time of praying and self-examination growth and holiness that you have ever... You cannot start a church by essentially neglecting your spiritual disciplines, which is what almost everybody does. You can't get so busy fundraising and so busy vision casting and so busy studying that basically your prayer life becomes thin. This is the time you've got to make this, put it into your understanding. And this is my job as a church planter. It used to be I could pray in my spare time. I can't afford that anymore. I need 2 hours at least a day of prayer and Bible study. If I can't get that in, I'm not going to be a good church planter. So that's the only way I'm going to make sure that I love these people. And I'm doing this because I love them and because I love God, and not because I want to succeed. One of the big problems with planting a church is you're, especially I think British people have even more of a problem with this than Americans, if I do say so. And that is a fear of failure can just overwhelm you in church planting. And it makes you self-absorbed and it makes you self-centered, and you have to have a dynamic prayer life to offset that, so that you're doing this out of love for God and love for people, which is always going to be at war with the feeling like I can't look bad. I've really got to succeed. I can't look like I'm a fool here. Linking, then, is pretty much the last thing here, is you have to find a way of preaching the gospel that connects to the people's aspirations, hopes, and pleasures. That's the reason I was saying there's all these intercanonical themes. The Bible gives you this wealth of approach. Don't think there's just one gospel presentation that hits everybody. It just doesn't. So you link the gospel to the heart, and you have to link the gospel to the community, which means how will you show the neighborhood that you are there for them and not just there for yourselves? How will you serve? How will you seek the common good? How will you connect with your neighbors? How will you make them say, I'm glad they're here? So you have to link the gospel to the heart and link the gospel to the community. And after you've figured that out, that's what we would call our philosophy of ministry. You learn, you love, you link, and then you launch. And then I don't have to tell you much more than that. It's because if you're doing pioneer church planting or church planting, the launching is utterly different. In some cases, the launch is very small and slow and basically evangelism for quite a long time. And if it's church planting, it kind of goes big faster. And we have worship services, and we have this, and we have that. And those are both valid ways of launching. Come up with a launching plan. But don't just reach out and say, you know, I don't have a plan. Have a plan for launching. So I'm going to stop there because we have to take, we're on a different schedule. And you're not asking me questions and answers right now. We're going to be going into group life.